Today, we talk about the widening gap between rich and poor in Illinois. While new census numbers show that the median household income across the state has gone up, so has the increase in economic inequality.
At the same time that median income is rising, we have labor force participation actually falling. So there might be what economists call selection effects.
And how does this look when it's portrayed in art? A new Chicago exhibit looks at working life across America, and it's not at a museum, but at the library.
Working is actually the thread that runs through all of us. It's what we have in common, whether we're working or not. So some of us are working too much, and some of us can't find work.
And in our weekly politics segment, with all the focus on tonight's presidential debate, we ask, when are Tammy Duckworth and Mark Kirk going to face each other? That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. You may have heard the news last week that the median household income in the U.S. is rising. It's actually the third consecutive year there's been a statistically significant increase in the national median household income. That's new data out from the U.S. Census Bureau. In Illinois, the median household income has also risen to almost $60,000. But it turns out Illinois is one of eight states where income inequality has actually increased, meaning the wealthiest people are getting richer faster than the poorest. We're joined now by Marcus Casey. He's an economist at UIC, and he's here to explain a little bit more about the numbers. Hi, Marcus. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Hi. Thanks, Nyla.
What did we learn from this new data out from the Census Bureau, the median household income data that was out last week?
Well, we learned specifically about Illinois and in the U.S. in general that median income is rising, which is a very good thing. However, there are some potential caveats to that rise. So one thing that I would caution people in sort of thinking about these numbers is that at the same time that median income is rising, we have labor force participation actually falling. So there might be what economists call selection effects in that people who are continue to work are actually benefiting a lot from the recovery, but we have a lot fewer people in the labor market than we had back in 2007.
Mm-hmm. And when we look at this, there is something I highlighted when I first introduced this segment. Illinois is one of eight states where income inequality has actually increased, where there was a statistically significant increase in that. The Census Bureau measured something called the Gini Index. What's that?
Think of it as a simple one-dimensional number that helps describe the distribution of income in an area. So It ranges from 0 to 100% or 0 to 1, typically how we think about it, and where 0 being the being less inequality. 0, the extreme 0 means everybody has the same amount of income, whereas 1 being the most, one person in the economy essentially having all the income.
Mm-hmm. And when we see that number increasing in Illinois, what do you think that means?
It reflects what we essentially see on the ground, right? If you walk around, say, Chicago or some other places, you can see that, you know, these places are becoming richer and even amidst a lot of poverty. So it sort of suggests that the rich are definitely getting richer. In some respects, though, the published numbers might even underestimate the degree of inequality, because the one thing that the U.S. Census doesn't measure in the Gini coefficient is capital gains. And as we know, that capital gains constitute a large percentage of the income of very wealthy people. And if you include those, you might actually see a more extreme number.
So, Marcus, when we look at this data, we look at Illinois, we look at household income. So this is, and again, this is 2014 to 2015 numbers. We're looking at household income, the estimate in 2015 at about $59,000. And that's an increase over about $57,000 from the 2014 period. So that's good, right? Household income is rising, but how do we track compared to the rest of the country? It seems like, are we keeping up? Because I know traditionally Illinois has been behind in terms of recovery and growth since the Great Recession.
In terms of the rate of growth, I think we track pretty well. But given that Illinois is a more expensive state to live in, those numbers, we need it to actually be faster, especially in areas around, say, Chicago, where living at the median income is actually very difficult, given the increase in housing costs, the increase in congestion, commuting costs, and so on and so forth. So we actually need better. And I think we should probably be a little worried to some degree that we do continue to lag behind in other areas.
And why do you think that is? Why do you think the state as a whole is lagging behind?
I think there's a combination of factors. For one, we have a serious political problem in that we can't seem to get an established budget, and the uncertainty associated with the lack of sort of state fiscal responsibility on either side of the aisle probably makes a lot of companies a little worried about increasing employment here, raising wages, and also probably reduces the likelihood of new people, you know, potentially talented people who might want to start businesses and so on and so forth to move to Illinois.
You also said something, Marcus, I want to go back to the beginning. You said the numbers don't necessarily reflect perhaps, or maybe they do reflect a little bit of the employment situation, which is that there is a percentage of the population of people who maybe are underemployed or maybe just maybe lost work during the recession and haven't found that work again. Is that what you were saying?
Yes. So in the parlance of economists, we call this selection. You know, when we measure numbers, so in this case, the income numbers, we're only measuring for people who actually work. And so given that labor force participation has actually been declining, we have a large number of discouraged workers in the economy in general, in Illinois in particular, then that sort of suggests that if many of those people, many of whom tend to be lower skilled, especially males, black males in particular, if many of them moved into the labor market, it might actually push down our median numbers because they would be moving in on the lower end of the income scale.
Marcus, that said, what's your takeaway? What do you think people, because I think lots of people saw the headlines last week and said, oh, this looks good. Household income is going up. For people in Illinois, how do you think they should look at these numbers?
I think they should be pleased that things are getting better. I mean, the opposite, if they were getting worse, it's better than getting worse. But however, I wouldn't take this as an economic success. I would take this as we're on the right track, but we need to get our state fiscal house in order to develop some sort of certainty going forward into the future. And then perhaps some of these numbers, whether it be employment, income, or the poverty drops, might actually increase at a faster rate.
Right. And of course, given that these numbers are 2014 to 2015, this doesn't include what we've seen with the state's fiscal situation over the past year. And maybe that will start showing up in numbers of income in a year or two also.
Yeah, that's the concern. That's part of my concern, my caution in sort of interpreting these numbers.
Mm-hmm. Marcus Casey is an assistant professor of economics at UIC, the University of Illinois in Chicago, where he joins us from. Marcus, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo.
I'm somewhere in an industrial area.
I'm sitting at the office, in a very well-appointed one it is.
Talking to a jockey, Eddie Arroyo. Eddie's home here with his family.
I'm seated with Jill Friedman in her Greenwich Village studio. She's a photographer. And
talking to Steve Hamilton, pitcher.
Nick Lindsay, who are you?
I'm a carpenter from South Carolina.
This is a hospital. Now, where are you?
No, what do you mean, where am I?
Thanks very much. I can use this.
Yeah, I think you
yeah,
can.
Okay,
yeah,
okay, great. Thank
All
you.
Right.
That's the incomparable Oriole historian and lifelong Chicagoan Studs Terkel talking to people about their jobs. His 1974 book, Working, People Talk About What They Do All Day and How They Feel About What They Do, has inspired a new multimedia exhibit that looks at what working Americans do today. The project is called Working in America, and it's a collaboration between Chicago Public Library and Project AND. It also includes a special radio series you're going to be hearing on Morning Edition that's a co-production between Project AND and Radio Diaries that started yesterday. We're joined now by Chicago Public Library's Commissioner Brian Bannon and Project AND's Artistic Director Jane Sachs, who created the initiative to bring this exhibit to the library. Jane, Brian, welcome to The 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks Thank you.
Us.
Jane, this is a multimedia exhibit. It has photos and text describing the everyday working lives of Americans in 2016, I should add. How did this project come about?
Well, it really came about that I was trying to think of how I could address issues of economic inequality through my work, which is arts and culture. And my father and Studs were friends, and I had an incredible education in the backseat of the car driving around the city with the two of them. And so I pulled the book off my shelf, Working, and I thought I'm going to revisit Working, and realized it was actually the 40th anniversary. And I thought that's an incredible moment to start. And I wanted to create a multi-platform opportunity for people to participate in a conversation about working in America now.
And it was really about every day that we hear about the workforce, the numbers, the statistics, but we don't hear about the workers across the country. And so I asked Lindsay Dario, Pulitzer Prize winning photographer, to crisscross the country with me, and we chose 24 people in about 17 states to profile, an electrician, urban farmer, professional escort, Olympic gold medalist. And then I approached Jeannie Gang, the incredible architect, to collaborate on the design, and then also got access to all the field recordings from studs that he did for the book. And so I approached Radio Diaries to collaborate on producing a radio series.
Jane, you mentioned economic inequality. It's something we've been talking about this hour on the show, and I want to sort of remind everybody the household income numbers that came out recently that showed Illinois is one of eight states that have seen a rise in income inequality over the past year, meaning that gap is getting bigger in Illinois. How important is it, do you think, for art to shed light on this issue?
Well, I think that art historically sheds light on issues actually before everyone else. You know, often art is ahead of the curve. It's ahead of advocacy and policy and societies. And so often art is really leads the evolution and the revolutions. And so I think it's really important for art to be part of that. At Project Ann, we believe that the democratic promise is equitable participation, and art is actually in a unique position to actually deliver on that promise. And so I think it's extremely important.
That's Jane Sachs, who's the artistic director of Project And. We're also speaking with Brian Bannon, who's the commissioner for the Chicago Public Library. We're talking about the Working in America exhibit, which is opened at the Chicago Public Library. It's going to be on display at the Harold Washington Library Center in Chicago through January of next year. Brian, I think Jane's talking about numbers, and I was just thinking many people may not realize that Harold Washington Library has roughly the same amount of visitors a year as the Art Institute of Chicago. Is that why you wanted the library to get involved in hosting this?
Yeah, you know, when we think about the role of a public library, I think we often sometimes have a traditional idea about a library as just a place to check out books, but in fact, we are centers of our communities. And you're right that the Harold Washington Library is a heavily trafficked building. People come here for lots of different reasons. But really what brings them together is their curiosity about the world. And so the opportunity to engage people who are already visiting the building with a new exhibit, with a new idea, to us is really an important part of the library's mission. And that really was why we were so excited when Jane came to us with this concept. And our understanding is the plan is to have this exhibit travel to libraries around the country. And, you know, the idea that we're free, we're open to everyone, we see the full cross-section of our city, it's really an ideal place for an exhibit such as Working to be on display and to engage the broader community in it.
Jane, can you tell us a little bit about what people will see when they come to the Harold Washington Library?
Yeah, I want to pick up on one thing Brian said, because it is so important that this exhibition is free and accessible, and that's why the libraries was just a natural partnership, and the Chicago Public Library has been an incredible partner in doing this, because libraries are what you go to find that you think is there, but you also find things you didn't know about, and that's really what learning is about, and so this is an incredible collaboration. So when people get to the library, they're going to see these saturated, huge photographs of 24 individuals. The exhibition is on the third floor, and so it's really of the library, and so it's really in the anatomy of the library. It's in the working part of the library where people come to study and check out books and read and think, and so it's really in the center of what the library is all about. And so they'll see these large photographs of individuals and individuals from across the country, as well as one of the major aspects of Working in America is an online opportunity to add your own photograph and working story, and it's called Your Working Story. And you can go to working.org and add your photograph and answer actually a couple of studs questions about your working life. And so the exhibition is really what you'll see. It's what you'll take away. People you may know, people you may never have known or that you don't see but actually are part of your life. And it's also what you'll give. You'll actually give your story and your experience. And so it's animated by the people who actually come to the exhibition. It really relies on the engagement and the participation of others.
Well, and as you're saying that, Jane, it is such a nice parallel with what Studs did with his work, finding stories with everyday people, maybe where you wouldn't expect stories to be. Brian, do you think the library is maybe even also a symbolic good setting for this exhibit?
It is, and I actually think that what we love about it being on the third floor, and by the way, this is an area of the library that we recently took down some old shelves that weren't being used and sort of repurposed it for an exhibition space. But what's exciting about it being specifically on the third floor is it is, just as Jane said, this is where our computer commons is, so people are coming into this space, they're applying for jobs, they're communicating with their families, those kinds of things. It's also on the same floor that we have our Maker Lab, where we have 3D printing and manufacturing, and so it really is kind of an exciting zone within the library where there's so many different kinds of activities that are taking place. And yes, I mean, the theme of working, the idea of the serendipity is all very much in line with what we think a public library is here to do. And to do it in an experiential way through this exhibit and through the many different programs that are going to be happening as part of it is really exciting and right in the wheelhouse of a library.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Jane Sachs and with Brian Bannon about the Working in America exhibition that just opened at the Chicago Public Library. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Tuning into the 21st, we're talking about Working in America. It's a special project that has just opened at the Chicago Public Library. It's a collaboration between the Chicago Public Library and Project AND. Project AND is also part of a special radio series. It started yesterday on Morning Edition. It's a co-production with Radio Diaries. All of this is to continue the work that Studs Terkel started in 1974. With his book Working, people talk about what they do all day and how they feel about what they do. We're taking a 2016 version of this. We've been talking to the artistic director of Project AND, Jane Sachs, and the commissioner of the Chicago Public Library, Brian Bannon. Brian, before we get to the programs, as I'm thinking about that area that you've described, the Maker Lab, that's a pretty heavily trafficked area of the Harold Washington Library. But as I'm also thinking about people coming to the library, I wonder if they're used to seeing exhibits of this magnitude in that space, because oftentimes there are photographs that maybe are housed on the ground floor. Now that it's been open, I wonder what kind of response you're getting from people who are maybe happening upon the exhibit just because they happen to be in the library?
Yeah, you know, I actually walked through there this morning, and what was really fun is that there is a bank of tables where people do homework and those kinds of things, and you can just see people, you know, they're going in their normal routine, and then they see this exhibit there, and so they'll leave their things and they'll walk through it. In fact, I think, you know, Jane, when you and I were there just the other day, as we were walking through, I could see people who were doing their regular routine, whether it was coming to a computer or whether it was going to study and taking note. And like I said, this is the first time that we've done an exhibit in this area of the library. Typically, exhibits are on the first floor or in our exhibit hall on the ninth floor. And so it's been fun to put something literally right at the center of this hub of activity and seeing people engaging with it.
Jane, Brian mentioned a couple other events. I know there's a series of working lunches. Do either of you want to jump in and just sort of explain what those lunches are going to be? I think those start next week, correct?
Yeah, so we really wanted to have a whole range of ways to engage with the ideas. I mean, working is actually the thread that runs through all of us. It's what we have in common, whether we're working or not. So some of us are working too much and some of us can't find work. But anything in between, we all have a real common thread of the relationship to work. And so a lot of the programs that we're developing are really about that. So we decided to do a series of Join Us for a Working Lunch. And they're really people coming to talk about their work and what they do. We have a doctor. We have a social activist. We have a whole range of people. And they're not coming as experts on the world. They're coming as experts on their life, which is really about what Studs did, saying that we are the experts on our lives, and so we actually can speak about them with authority and agency and power. We're going to collaborate with You Media and really talk about youth interviewing and talking about their working lives. We have a whole range of partnerships with community-based groups and national organizations such as Access Living and the Shriver Center for Poverty Law and Center for American Progress, Women Employed. So we're going to be having different groups come in and talking about their working lives. And then we're going to do another big program in the evening in addition to the panel we did for the opening, really talking about the making of working in America, and that will be with the lead creative team, including Jeannie Gang and Joe Richman and myself, really talking about what it means to do this kind of work and how we all come from different places to do it. You know, so I'm the one who approached everybody and said, we should build this thing together, but what does it mean to do that kind of work? And so I just want to emphasize the fact that it's really about us talking about our working lives and the brilliance of the line of Studs' book, how we feel about what we do all day. And that's what's been great about having it right at the center in the guts of the library, is that I'm always talking to people who are just around the library about the exhibition and talking to them about what they're doing and how they feel about it. And it's been really extraordinary.
Well, Jane, I wonder if you can explain a little bit about how you found the people in the exhibit, how you chose them, how you decided to make them the subjects of this.
No, really what we did is, you know, some of the people I knew, and then there was a kind of small team of people doing research, and research is, you know, sometimes a scientific sport, and sometimes, you know, it's saying somebody knows someone who would be really interested. You know, I did a lot of research reading, I mean, obviously really studying Studs' book and how he chose them, and some were very serendipitous, and sometimes proximity is, you know, where genius happens. You know, you just know someone next to someone else. And I really wanted it to be a continuation of his discussion, so it's not kind of matching it. But once I got access to all the interviews, we decided it would be really wonderful to go back and try to find the people who are still alive from the book. And so there are some that cross over from the exhibit and also into the radio series. And then other people really thinking about what's changed over the last 40 years. And so it really came down to 24 people that would be enough of a range that we could all find someone we know and some way to enter in to the exhibit, and then also things that actually push us and make us think differently. And so people like Lucy McBath, who is the mother of Jordan Davis, who was a young African-American man who was murdered in Florida. And, you know, since his murder, she's become a national advocate and leader in gun violence. And I approached her and said, you know, the racism and the violence of our society has created work for you. And when you talk to her about what her work is, she talks about the first thing is mothering her son, Jordan. And so really it was thinking about how people talked about work. And so once I had the profiles of people and really thinking about kind of where they lived in the country and what kind of work they did, then I really had the hard job of picking how their stories would be in dialogue with other people in the exhibit. And so that was also a very important aspect of it.
Jane, what did it make you think about how much things have changed in terms of thinking about working in America, especially as we're thinking about income inequality? But you're thinking about 40 years ago to now. What have you come away from this thinking?
I think there's a couple things. One is, you know, when did we lose sight of the worker and just start focusing on the workforce, which is what makes up the workforce is the worker. And we've kind of stopped talking about the worker. We talk about the workforce. And so when did the individual get lost in that? And I think also, you know, really one of the big surprises is kind of what I'm always faced with in a way in my work is how many people are invisible and are actually kept invisible in our society. And so many people, when we were asking them about their work life, said this was the first time anyone asked them about how they felt about their work and, you know, how they felt about what they do all day.
I think the other thing is that people think it's the internet that has changed our lives so much, and really it's the shift from manufacturing to service, and that's really been the big shift in the last 40 years. And so really thinking about how do people think about their work in a way that's different than they did 40 years ago. There's certain expectations people don't have anymore that they used to have 40 years ago. But I also want to make the point that there are populations that struggled 40 years ago and 50 years ago and are still struggling, and it's even worse.
Jane, I just wanted to pick up on something we were talking about before the break, is you're talking about people being invisible and how people are still sort of invisible. Brian, I can't help but think about the patrons of people who come into the Chicago Public Library. And when we think about the Harold Washington Library in particular, how many different people converge there? As you said, that's where people are applying for jobs, people who don't have internet access. I'm thinking about members of Chicago's homeless population that come into the library to check out books. I wonder if you feel like there's, if this exhibit is a way to bring art to people who maybe wouldn't have an opportunity to be in the Art Institute or other of Chicago's museums that are maybe not as accessible to everybody?
Well, I would say yes and. I mean, I think that one of the things that's so unique about a public library, and this is certainly the case of the Harold Washington Library, is that we literally touch the full spectrum of the community. Recently, we actually looked at market research data against the folks who are checking out materials at Chicago Public Library, and one of the things that we thought was really unusual and important is that we literally have market penetration in the full spectrum of Chicago. So the very wealthiest to the very poorest, the young and old, and across the full city. And so what we think is actually really special about an exhibit like what we have with Project AND and working is that it is engaging a full spectrum of Chicago, not just one piece of Chicago. And I think that oftentimes when you're looking at other institutions around the city, and whether it's whether it's some of our museums or whether it's various different, is that we're even more fragmented today than we really have been at any other point in history. So it's sort of interesting that we have more access to information than at any point in history, and yet we are more and more fragmented in terms of how we access it and more siloed. And so what we actually think is the real value proposition of a public library is that we get to touch upon the full spectrum of the community and are really one of the only, if not the only, institutions left that really does connect the full spectrum. And so that's the part that we think is so special about an exhibit like this one.
Jane, as we started this conversation, it struck me that you said you used to sit in the back of the car with your dad, who was friends with Studs, and hear them talk about that. How much did that shape what you did with this new multimedia project? Are there specific conversations, or was it just a sensibility about those that you feel like you've brought to this?
Oh, I mean, it was very influential. I mean, my parents met Studs through their political engagement in civil rights and the anti-Vietnam War and so many things that were based in the city, and really understanding kind of the good, bad, and ugly and inspiring of living in a city like Chicago, and really learning about it from somebody like Studs and also from my father, Alan Sachs, really thinking about what it means to engage a whole city and really understand your place in it had a huge, huge influence. And I have actually dedicated the exhibition to them, saying that they both felt that there were no average people. And so that was what was really exciting for me, was really to understand the connective tissue of a city, not just the kind of landmarks of it, but what really makes up a city that is as segregated as our city, that has such a unique history, that is such a working city, and that was a huge impact. And then I got to know Studs later as an adult too, and really understanding stories, and both of them were incredible storytellers. And so really going through driving through the city with the two of them and understanding kind of history being made of stories and history being made in the present tense as well as in the past, really understanding where things come from and how you're part of them at the moment that you're living. So it was a really very, very influential, and it really has influenced the way I see my work and the way I see people.
I think one of the big takeaways was I realized that there were so many people that we allow to remain invisible in our society, and so many that we actually insist are invisible, as well as so many stories in history that we don't engage.
Jean, what does it mean for you to be able to expand on that work?
Oh, it's so important to me to create experiences that challenge and push and risk and create empathy. And I really see my work as wanting to be part of adding oxygen and audiences to things that are less known and less understood and less visible, and seeing connections between most everything and in kind of unusual ways. And so it's, you know, I joke that my father and studs were like from Jewish Central Casting, and they were, you know, it was like you could have made up these two guys. But just that kind of deep commitment to the times you live in and having influence on the times after you live is at the center of what I do.
That's Jane Sachs, the artistic director of Project Anne. I want to thank also Brian Bannon, who's the commissioner for the Chicago Public Library. Their collaboration, the project called Working in America, is on display at the Harold Washington Library Center in Chicago. There's also lunches for those in the Chicago area that's going to start next week every Thursday. There's ways to participate online. And for everybody listening to Morning Edition and All Things Considered, they can hear some of these stories. That's a co-production between Project Anne and Radio Diaries. Jane, Brian, thank you so much for being with me.
Thank you.
Last night, a crowd gathered to draw messages in chalk across the University of Illinois campus. It was because of an event hosted by one sorority to raise awareness about police brutality. Producer Christine Herman was there last night. Here's her report.
1, 2, 3, Tamir Rice.
That's about 150 people saying the names of individual Americans who have lost their lives due to police brutality over the past 50 years. The U of I chapter of the sorority Alpha Kappa Alpha organized the event after the shooting deaths of Terrence Crutcher in Tulsa and Keith Lamont Scott in Charlotte. Here's sorority historian Lola Ogunfemi.
We want everybody to know that just because things are happening hundreds of miles away doesn't mean that they're irrelevant to us.
Karen Olowu is a junior at the University of Illinois.
Black Americans will no longer be silent and no longer play nice while our children are murdered. So we're going to do something about it.
Participants use chalk to write messages such as fight racism and colored skin is not a weapon along the quad. The organizers say they hope people recognize police brutality and racism affect everyone.
Thanks to Christine Herman for producing that. Tomorrow, we're going to be speaking to Black parents across Illinois about how they're processing recent events, especially with their children. If you're a parent, what are you saying? We'd really love to hear from you on this. You can feel free to email us. Our email address is talk@21stshow.org. We've got a post up on our Facebook page. You can also message us there. So search for the 21st to like us, or you can call our hotline with your comments. Our phone number for our hotline is 217-300-2121. That's 217-300-2121. And we're going to be talking about all of this on tomorrow's program, as well as how African-American adults are processing this within their own communities. Stay tuned to the 21st. Coming up, we're going to be having our weekly politics segment, our roundup. The AP's Sarah Burnett is going to be joining us, along with the Herald and Review's Dan Petrella. Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. There's no limits right now on how much money will be pouring into the race for Illinois comptroller. Speaking of money, the presidential candidate's daughters are fundraising in Illinois this week. And speaking of the presidential race, with all eyes on tonight's big debate, when are Mark Kirk and Tammy Duckworth going to face each other? Those are the few of the headlines we're talking about for our weekly Monday political roundup. Joining us today for Sarah Burnett. She's a politics reporter for the Associated Press, joining us from the AP Bureau in Chicago. Hey, Sarah.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Also on the line with us is Dan Petrella. He's the Springfield Bureau Chief for Lee Enterprise Newspapers, for the Herald and Review, the Pantograph, a couple other papers, joining us from the State House Press Room in Springfield. Hey, Dan, welcome to the 21st.
Hi, Nella. Thanks for having me.
Let's start with the comptroller's race. GOP comptroller Leslie Munger's campaign reported alone just over a quarter million dollar contribution, from her husband on Sunday. That blew open the limits of donations for both campaigns. Her opponent, Democrat Susana Mendoza, is calling this beyond the pale. First, who wants to jump in here? Dan, can you explain why this $250,000 contribution changes campaign finance rules for this race?
Sure. The way the rules work in Illinois is that there are limits on how much individuals or corporations or political committees can contribute unless a candidate receives a contribution of $250,000 or more from any individual. And then that removes the restrictions, and basically all bets are off in terms of how much money can be spent on a race. We saw Governor Bruce Rauner do this himself back in 2014 when he was elected. So it really can change how much money can flow into these races.
So, Sarah, can you explain this? Because I think this might sound weird to people who are listening. So basically, if someone gives a lot of money, that means that anyone can give as much money as possible?
Well, it's if someone gives this large amount of money, either
to their
own
campaign
or someone within their own immediate family. So it's basically designed to say, like, look, if there's one really rich person in the race, we need to be able to lift the limits so that the other guy can compete, or woman in this case. The interesting thing about this, of course, is that a lot of people are seeing this as another opportunity for Governor Rauner to then start funneling all kinds of money into this race. So we'll see if or when that happens.
Dan, are you surprised at the amount of attention that this comptroller race has gotten over the past couple of months?
Ordinarily, I would be, but given the prominence that the office has taken in the current budget impasse, it's not too much of a surprise. Because the state went almost a year without any sort of budget, the comptroller's office really played a huge role in prioritizing when payments went out and to who when money was available. And so it's really seen as a key position now that the state has had such trouble getting a budget agreement.
Let's move on to another topic. Go ahead, Sarah. Did you want to add something else?
No, I just was going to add that, you know, this is sort of being seen as the ultimate proxy war. I think we're hearing that phrase more and more to describe Rauner versus Madigan. But Susana Mendoza obviously has had the support of Speaker Madigan and, you know, was in his house at one point. And Leslie Munger, obviously the handpicked person picked by Rauner himself.
I wanted to switch topics just for a minute. Lots of eyes are on the first presidential debate that is happening this evening. But in the U.S. Senate race that's happening here in Illinois, lots of national attention on that race. Senator Mark Kirk running against Representative Tammy Duckworth for his seat have still not agreed on a debate schedule. Sarah, what's holding this up?
Sure. Well, there seems to be some disagreement between the two campaigns about which debates to do, who agreed to what, when. The one thing we know for sure is that, or I guess we believe with some level of confidence, that both of them will sit down with the Chicago Tribune editorial board on Monday. That's obviously something that's live streamed during the day. So far, they have not committed jointly to appear on any televised evening debates, the kind of thing that we typically see at least one, if not two or three of, in a campaign or in a race of this importance. And the Duckworth campaign has listed the three debates that they'll be doing. There's one in Springfield and one in Chicago, televised beyond the Chicago Tribune one. The Kirk campaign apparently has other ones that they were hoping to do. And so we're still kind of waiting to find out what's going to happen.
So the Duckworth campaign is committing to debates, but it sounds like the Kirk campaign is not committing to the same ones. Is that what you're saying, Sarah?
Pretty much, yeah. And it's possible that they will ultimately. But the Duckworth campaign put out a release a couple weeks ago saying these are the debates she's going to do. And the Kirk campaign was like hold on a minute, we didn't agree to those. And so I think they're going back and forth between the two campaigns. It's every week we're told, soon, we'll tell you. But, you know, the days are starting to tick down now.
Dan, how unusual is it for a race this prominent to have, well, it may happen, but is it unusual at this point in a race for a race of this prominence to not have a debate on the schedule, at least on the books?
I would think so. I mean, there's almost always at least one debate like this in a U.S. Senate race in Illinois. So I think it would be maybe not completely unprecedented, but it would be pretty rare for the candidates not to get together in front of voters before Election Day.
And when we're talking about this campaign, Sarah, over the weekend, the Chicago Tribune had a story detailing how both Senator Kirk and Representative Duckworth have embellished their roles on September 11th. And I wondered how that plays, especially for Duckworth, who has been talking about Kirk and his various misstatements of his military record.
Well, and with both these two, I mean, you are seeing a huge focus on their records as veterans, their national security chops, who's going to be best to keep the country and the state of Illinois safe. And so it's sort of an interesting story that the Tribune had in which both of them, you know, Duckworth often goes around, and when she recounts what happened on September 11th, she talks about being in command of her Air National Guard unit that was at Midway Airport and being ready to go. She doesn't always mention that she was on that day vacationing in Scotland. And her campaign says she was, you know, on the phone, you know, trying desperately to get back here. Kirk has sort of another version of this story in which he says that he was with Donald Rumsfeld when Rumsfeld learned that America was under attack, and that's not quite true. They were in a meeting earlier that day, and then when he actually learned, they were in separate meetings. And so, you know, I think Duckworth obviously has gone after Kirk for previous untruths, misstatements about his own military record. This kind of doesn't help her when she's trying to be the person taking the higher ground on that.
Dan, to Sarah's point about how much of this race has focused on security and military and sort of their military records and national security, Dan, I'm curious, I mean, how important do you think this is actually an issue for Illinois voters? Do you think this is something that they think will, it sort of seems like something that the campaign thinks will determine voting choice. Do you think this is something that Illinois voters are really think is an important issue for their senators?
I think to some extent it's an issue, but I think probably voters are more concerned about the economy and about other issues like that. You know, depending on which presidential candidate they support, electing a senator who's going to support their chosen candidate's agenda once they reach the White House, that kind of thing. So I think this is one aspect of that, but I don't know if it's a deciding issue for the majority of voters.
Mm-hmm. Dan, I wanted to ask you, last week, independent candidate David Gill had his appeal denied for his attempt to be on the ballot for the U.S. House. He said he's appealing to the U.S. Supreme Court. Can you fill us up to speed with what's happening with that and what are his chances of this being heard?
Sure. It's been a roller coaster ride for Dr. Gill over the last month or so. His attorneys acknowledge that anytime you appeal anything to the U.S. Supreme Court, it's a long shot. Basically, he collected about 8,500 signatures on his petitions, valid signatures, that is, and he needed 10,754, filed a federal lawsuit challenging that requirement, saying that it's unfair because the Democrat and the Republican in the race only had to collect about 740 signatures. Got a federal judge here in Springfield to not rule on the merits of that argument, but say, you know, he collected an awful lot of signatures, and he and his supporters will be highly damaged if he's left off the ballot, so go ahead and put him on. Then the appeals court stepped in and blocked that order, and the State Board of Elections removed him from the ballot, so his sort of last-ditch effort here is to get the Supreme Court to step in and reverse the appeals court. Although I should say that on Friday, ballots started going out in the mail to military and overseas voters. So
he's not on the ballot.
He is not on those ballots, and it will be a complication if if a court later decides that he should go back on.
Well, and I can't, has the U.S. Supreme Court ever heard a case of this with this challenge?
Not that I'm aware of, and it would be, I think, pretty rare to them for them to step in at this point. But as his attorney said, there's really no other choice for him at this point other than to give up, because the court schedule at the appellate court level wouldn't hear the case until after Election Day. So it would be kind of a moot point by then.
Dan, on another topic, you just wrote a story about the state of Illinois' funding for public schools, and this is a little apart from politics for a minute, but I wanted to ask you what you think the options are on the table for improving school funding, and if we're hearing this even come up as a, even within campaigns.
You know, one really, really interesting thing, and talking to some people who are involved in the discussions that are going on right now, people on both sides of the political aisle have praised the way that people have sort of left the school funding issue out of this really heated campaign season we're seeing. The governor put together a commission that's made up of mostly lawmakers who've been meeting every couple weeks for about 2 months now, and they're supposed to put together a plan by February to change the way the state funds schools. And everything is political, so it looks like at the point where they actually come up with a plan, if they do, it will sort of become part of the larger budget negotiations. But the idea is to focus it more on the individual needs of school districts as opposed to sort of the one-size-fits-all approach that the state uses right now, and to give a boost to the higher poverty school districts that don't get as much from state and local resources.
Sarah, do you think this will gain any traction before the November election?
No, I don't. I mean, I think we all are working under the assumption that pretty much, you know, even while there are these meetings going on this issue, that pretty much any sort of action is on hold until after November. And then even then, who knows? I will say the list of things that this so far fairly unaccomplished legislature, in terms of, I say unaccomplished in terms of getting things done, to be clear, the list of things that they are going to need to do between after the election and next spring, between, you know, passing pension reform and a budget for this year and maybe next year, and then to add the school funding on top of it, and you know, the track record is not good with these people.
Yeah, Dan, that's a good point, Sarah. Darren, I wonder if you have any thoughts on that, as we sort of, the list just keeps getting longer, isn't it, for issues that our legislators need to address that seem like everything keeps getting put off until after the November election.
It really does. I mean, there's not really even an opportunity for them to take anything up before the election because they're not scheduled to be back here in the Capitol until afterwards. So, you know, I think it is a good sign that people are meeting and talking about these issues, but, you know, whether they can come to some sort of compromise that fits into a larger budget agreement is a big question. They held school funding outside of the rest of the budget for the past couple of years, and I don't know if they can continue to address it that way or not.
That's Dan Petrella. He is the Springfield Bureau Chief for Lee Enterprise Newspapers from the State House in Springfield. I want to thank Sarah Burnett as well, politics reporter for the AP. The one topic we didn't get to, but I'll just mention it for both of you, is it's Daughter's Week for the presidential race in Illinois, right? Sarah, we have Ivanka Trump is scheduled to be at fundraisers in Peoria and Quincy this week, right? And then I know Chelsea Clinton is supposed to be at a fundraiser for her mother in Chicago on Friday. So I know both of you guys will be paying attention to that. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for today. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to be talking to Black parents across Illinois about how they're processing recent events and how they're discussing that, not just with their children, but within their own communities. We'd love to hear from you on this issue. You can email us. Our email address is talk@21stshow.org. We have a post up on our Facebook page. If you search for us on Facebook, The 21st, you can like us. You can see that post. You can comment there. You can message us if you want to send us a private message. You can also leave us a voicemail. Our hotline is 217-300-2121. Again, our phone number, 217-300-2121, with your comments on that. That's all the time we have for today. You can always get all of our contact information at our website, www.21stshow.org. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.